Hi, this is Bill Janovitz of Buffalo Tom, an author most recently of The Cars, Let the Stories Be Told, and you're listening to Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room to promote his new book, The Cars, Let the Stories Be Told, please welcome singer, songwriter, guitarist, and author, Mr. Bill Janovitz. Hey Bill, how you doing?
Good, thanks Pat. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Bill, this book is right off the bat, I got to kiss your ass. This book is fantastic.
Thank you.
I mean, it covers everything. Sometimes when I read a book like this, it'll peter out at the end. It'll say, you know, the band went on to record four more albums or whatever. But you get into the nuts and bolts of every single aspect of the Cars career, and I am loving it. So thank
you. Oh, good. I'm glad you enjoy it. Yeah, I'm thorough by nature.
Now, let me ask you, how long does it take to write a book like this? I mean, you have to do all these interviews. You have to compile everything. How long did it take you?
It took me about a year and a half, I think, from start to finish. And then, you know, another 6 months for it to, you know, come out. And it's, you know, whatever I had to do to get it out production-wise, blah, blah, blah. But the book itself, this wasn't that long compared to my previous book about Leon Russell, which was a pretty intense research project and had to be really post-edited, you know, down to something at least as big as it is. It was even bigger. But this book had the benefit of really the three surviving members being around and pretty much being within consensus on by far the majority of most important topics. So it went pretty smoothly. I mean, I didn't feel like I was wrestling with this book at all. And I'm not I think most nonfiction authors do, like, the research is one component and then they follow it up by writing, you know? I'm kind of writing as I go, which is not advisable, I think, for most people. It becomes unwieldy, but it's just sort of the way my brain works. I'm impatient to see a story unfold. And I want to see the story start to unfold before I research the aspects that I think are important. I don't know. Maybe these are just things I tell myself to make myself feel better.
Let me ask you this. Buffalo Tom has 11 albums in their discography. You now have four books that you've written. Which is your day job, musician or author?
Neither. It's real estate agent. It's the only thing I actually make my living and able to send my kids to college, you know. The other things are just passions and loves, labors of love. You know, I'm sure I could, if I dedicated myself to staying on the road, as I, you know, if we had redoubled our efforts, you know, as a band and ignored our budding families in the late 90s, we probably could have continued to make a living at it. Maybe we would have gone on to better success. I doubt it. With authoring, the publishing industry is not very lucrative unless you're like, you know, Michael Lewis or you know, whatever the best-selling nonfiction authors are.
Yeah, Stephen King, someone like that.
Sure.
All right. Thank you for that honest answer. Let me before we get too far, I want to let everyone know where they can find out all about Bill. You can go to BillJanovitz.com/blog, Facebook, Bill.Janovitz, and Instagram at Bill Janovitz.
Yeah, those all work.
I think that covers it. Love the title. I love the Let the Stories Be Told. It's perfect. You know, a line from the song, and it just is perfect. And the book is out now, folks. You can get it everywhere. And I will be giving away two copies in conjunction with this episode. So if you're a Patreon supporter, you will be winning one of those copies. I mean, when I opened up this book and the first thing I did, I went to the back in the index. I'm like, let's see how deep into the woods we're going to get. So the first thing I looked up was Niagara Falls. Greg Sole album.
Yeah.
And as soon as I saw that that was in the index, I'm like, oh, we're gonna hear about everything. Perfect.
Yeah. I mean, if you knew that record, I don't know if you knew that record. It's a fantastic little record.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, between that and Elliot's solo record, Elliot Easton's solo record, those are my two favorites.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, there's so much stuff with this band. Now, I feel like this is the definitive book on the Cars. During your interviews with Elliot, Greg, and David, did any of them indicate that they might someday write their own book?
Elliot, when I was first talking to him, he was the first point of contact because as I explained in the book, I was able to play music with him at this performance at a benefit in Los Angeles called the Wild Honey Benefit. And when I pitched this to him, he seemed gung ho. I'm jumping ahead here.
Sure.
We established a bit of a conversation back and forth. He had already had my first Stones book. But then when it didn't come together, because Rick Ocasek shot the idea down before it even got off the ground. He said, well, I've got my own book that I would like to do. I think that's great. I think he's got a book in him, but I wanted to, sort of get this Cars book going. It's hard to sell to a publisher a book like that, one member of a band that wasn't the leader of the band kind of thing,
Yeah. And so after that, you were on your way.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was just answering your one question about, do these guys have books, or did they? I don't think Rick or David, I'm sorry. I don't think David or Greg had put pen to paper or the idea of doing their own book. But I wasn't quite on my way. I wrote an article about the experience of playing with Elliot, and he was the focal point of an article about the Cars, which was called The Zen of Elliot Easton, and that's still online at rockandrollglobe.com. And he loved it. It wasn't just about him, but it really brought – it's like, this is a great band. We all love them. But look, here's this secret weapon, almost secret weapon, this guitar player that was doing these amazing things. And that's when he ran up the flagpole. So Rick was still around. It was the year that Rick died, in fact, later on that year. But in the meantime, I was offered this this idea from the estate of Leon Russell to do a Leon Russell bio. They were looking for a writer to write his story. So I did that, and that got pretty good acclaim. It was a New York Times bestseller. Elliot liked it. He blurbed it. The other guys eventually got it in the Cars. And at that point, as I said, Rick had passed away. So these guys were all pretty much ready to go, except Elliot. Elliot was a little bit more reluctant. He wanted management sort of to bless it. Management was really just sort of non-responsive, period. And their management is Jeff Kramer, who manages Bob Dylan and Paul Simon. I'm sure an email from Bill Genovese is just an annoyance at best, opening it. So, I mean, I was fortunate to have these three guys go. Eventually, all three of them go, yeah, let's do it. It's your story to tell. So as Greg said at the beginning of this whole thing, he said, let the stories be told. And I said, you just handed me the title of the book.
And so you don't start this thing until everyone's on board, because it might be a waste of time if you do that.
Well, everyone, in this case, I don't know what would have been a waste of time. Like, if I had two of the three, I think I would have been okay.
Okay.
But there are certain bands that, it's not as strong a book without having Ben and Rick's voice in there. But I mean, I did the best I could with all those that surrounded them now that they're both passed away. And I think... Well, I'm not sure. let me take that back. In some ways, this book is way more rich and honest than it probably would have been had Rick and Ben still been around. I mean, if they had been around and weren't either one or both of them and weren't cooperating, then I'd still have these three guys talking. But I don't know if these three guys would have been as honest in their opinions about how it went down. So, it's a plus and minus. But yeah, I mean, look, I was, it's hard to say if this or that. I mean, I was just
very fortunate to have these guys and to have their cooperation still supporting the book when it's not really, you know, it's benefiting them in terms of their legacy, I think, and to get their points of view out there. But it's my book, so they're just being very generous with supporting it all the way through.
Well, I feel like without their participation, it's not as valid as it would be. And having them involved, I mean, it's just reading their own words as told to you as a fan is just fantastic. Elliot was on this show about 11 years ago now, and we got to sit down with him for 2 full hours. And when he was telling all this stuff that I had never known, at that point I thought, well, this guy has a book in him. But having a book in you and actually writing a book are two wildly different things for sure.
Everybody's got a book in them.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. Everyone has stories. So.
Yeah, it's being able to organize it all. And I'm not the most detail-oriented, organized person by nature. So writing is my way of organizing my thoughts. And, I can actually converse, but I think I'm better in written form, you know. But yeah, I mean, to your point, these three guys all had amazing stories. And like any group, not just a band, but any group of people, a family, a workplace, a team of any kind, everybody has different memories of how things went down or things that did go down. Some people had no memory of, you know, there's the Rashomon effect of like conflicting points of view on certain things. But I felt like in this case, there wasn't a whole lot of conflicting, you know, there was more like, well, he saw it that way. Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, if he said that happened, yeah, it did happen. Or he saw it this way. But I mean, one of my favorite quotes that jumps to memory in the book is, and it points to the nature of kind of their personalities and their group personalities, is David talking about like being pissed off at like Rick bringing them all the way over to France as this like charade in his mind of like they were all going to do press. And the only person that ended up doing press was Rick. So like, why are we over here? And he said he thought it was like in this sort of more malevolent, fraudulent kind of charade thing. And Elliot said, well, that it did happen, but I don't know if it was as diabolical as David thinks it was. I love the word diabolical there.
Yeah. another thing I like about this book is you get into the nitty gritty of recording and equipment and things like this. And it's not too tedious though for a non-musician to enjoy it. Cause I've read books where people are getting, you know, into the recording process and you talk a lot about Roy Thomas Baker, but you made it so that I could, without knowing anything about it, I really understood what he was doing and what was going on.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, it depends. I think different readers will have, the consensus of readers, the great majority will agree that with your statement. I hope so. I could have gone even geekier, of course.
Sure.
When I'm with musician friends or people that are like, want to know explanations of the stuff, I can go pretty deep. I don't go as deep as engineers go because I'm not an engineer, but yeah, it's a balance, and it's a balance with all my music books. It's like, how much do people really want to know about a 40-track machine as opposed to a 24-track machine? But it's kind of a big deal, you know, in 1978 to have a 40-track machine. So nowadays we have unlimited tracks to work with digital. But back then it was like a, you know, Roy Thomas Baker who had just come off of Bohemian Rhapsody by linking two 24-track tape machines together and bouncing these things down to have all this room to open up more tracks. You know, for the Beatles to imagine that when they were recording on 4 tracks would be, you know, so that kind of stuff is important. Tape as opposed to digital is really important. And you kind of see that with this band in particular, starting in 78 and then ending kind of in 84, 85, where they've gone early digital and the difference in the sound.
Yeah, I mean, in your opinion, do you feel that Roy Thomas Baker might have been the only producer that could get these guys on tape?
No, I don't think he was the only one. I think he was crucial, though, to what he achieved with them. I don't know what they would have been like, say, in the earliest days. I mean, who else was a big producer at that time? I mean, Mutt Lang himself was sort of producing big time records around that time with AC/DC, I think. And
Jack Douglas was around.
Yeah, for sure. Jack Douglas. I mean, who did the Chris Thomas? Is that the guy?
Yeah.
Pretenders. I mean, those guys that really kind of captured bands on tape like that. I mean, compare the Cars debut to those other records, and it punches you in the gut. I mean, it's like stands out to this day. It's what Roy Thomas Baker talked about with sparseness, but like, you know, just dynamics, relief, big, go big here, go small here, but punchy tape, apparent volume versus actual volume, tape compression and saturation. I mean, there's actually a design and an intention behind the results. But he became right off the bat. I mean, first of all, he was already famous. So by having his imprimatur and going to London to record at Air Studios with, you know, George Martin's studio. I mean, this was like a whirlwind thing from within their first year of being, you know? And so to have his name on the record, people took it really seriously right out of the gate. And to have that batch of songs produced by that guy in that year and on that record label was, these are all the zeitgeist things coming together.
Yeah.
And he really did become almost like a sixth member of the band. He didn't, not in as much as like Mutt did with Def Leppard. He wasn't writing. He wasn't really even arranging with them. He was just capturing who they were and in the best possible oral, you know, sort of audio way. And I compare the relationship of those four records that he did, their first four records, with like Jimmy Miller and the Stones or George Martin with the Beatles. It's like, it was a real relationship between those guys. And, you know, I don't think those records would be what they are had it not be for RTB.
Yeah, they, I mean, it's like nothing I ever heard before at the time. I remember, how old was I when this came out? I was probably, I don't know, 13, and the neighbors had it and let me borrow it, and I put it on my stereo, and I was like, couldn't believe what I was hearing. And then just, you know, three singles right in a row. I mean, the whole thing, I love that album cover, even though in the book they talk about David's version of the album cover, which I don't know if it's because the original album cover is so iconic, but when I see what David mocked up, it doesn't look like it fits to me.
I agree. It looks more, you know, punk rock and amateurish, which isn't who they were. It's who they kind of maybe thought themselves as being, but I mean, it's not an accident that their next record, I mean, for all the bemoaning of that first record, that I understand their point of view from that they wanted to be cool and hip, and this represented like foreigner to them or something, you know,
right. Yeah.
Mainstream. But then they follow it up with Candy O with a pinup girl on the cover of a car. It's not that much of a stretch, you know?
Yeah, and Shake It Up, they have a girl on that album cover too. So,
yeah,
I mean,
there you go. Yeah.
There's a girl on the cover of Heartbeat City also. So, I mean, who knows?
Yeah, again, pinup art, right?
Yeah. Now, I did give you some homework, Bill. I wanted to talk about your top five car songs in no particular order, but let's go in reverse order of the songs you picked. One of the songs you picked was Drive from Heartbeat City.
Gonna tell you when it's too late. Who's gonna tell you things aren't so great? You can't go on. Nothing's wrong. What the? Who's gonna drive you home tonight? Who's gonna pick you up?
That's the band's biggest hit, peaking at number three. Tell me why you picked Drive.
Well, I mean, so I'm roughly your age, I guess. I'm 59. I was 12 when that record came out. The first record came out. So from that to pretty much, this is like their peak, you know, Heartbeat City, and then this is like essentially kind of should have been maybe their last record,
right?
Their last record of
of stuff that they brought, you know, of fresh material. The follow-up record, the one that really broke them up door to door, was you know, stuff that they had lying around for a while, and they needed to put one more record out. So my point is, for this, these two, I was a senior in high school when Heartbeat City came out. So those two records, the debut and Heartbeat City, sort of bookend my whole adolescence and my whole, you know, from middle school right through the end of high school. So they were there every step of the way, you know. And but when Heartbeat City came out, it was the first record where I was like, oh man, this, like, I was already attuned enough and had opinions enough to think that, oh, this record sounds really thin and cheesy and digital, and it was competing with like Rockwell's, you know, somebody watching over me, and all this synth pop that was starting to really take hold, and Pyromania, Def Leppard, which was Mutt Lange's sort of calling card at that point. I mean, he had already had calling cards, but that was his gigantic seller. That stuff sounded instantly dated to me. Like, I just didn't like the sound. I didn't like where music production was going. I don't know if I could have articulated it as much when I was 17, but I wanted, you know, I was already into whatever, Talking Heads and REM and Husker Du and maybe the Replacements at that point already. So I was into like bringing it back to the garage, really,
right,
in a lot of ways. I really liked, New Order when I was a junior in high school or something. So I didn't dislike electronica. In fact, I liked a lot of electronica, but I wanted beefy sounds. Anyway, however, all of those songs, first of all, to me, to this day, not all of them, but a bulk of Heartbeat City sounds like, if you listen to it without the production in your head, go, oh, any of these could have been Roy Thomas Baker.
Yeah.
Car songs. Drive, though, I'm not trying to – Drive is the one song where I don't try to excuse the production. I embrace that sort of digital – because it's warm. It's – first of all, you've got Ben singing it, Ben Orr, who rounds off everything. And everything is like in soft focus with Ben, the way he looked, the way he sounded. It's just this cushiony hug of an embrace of a song. Never mind not to mention – the deep emotion of that song. To me, it sounded like an updated version of I'm Not in Love or something by 10cc.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, it's these overlapping and vocals as an instrument, you know, and as a pad. And I mean, for me, I don't think it was our prom theme, but it might as well have been, you know. It was like a perfect, as I say in the book, it was a perfect soundtrack to, you know, romantic dramas, real and imagined, in high school. So yeah, that song means a lot to me. And to me, it's like one of the signature, if not the signature ballads of the 80s.
Yeah, true. And Ben Orr, he just looks like a model on the cover of a romance novel. I mean, that's what he looks like to me. You touch on it in the book a little bit about how some people can't discern if Ben is singing or if Rick is singing. And that always puzzled me, because I always could. I always knew, oh, that's Ben. Oh, that's Rick. And because they don't really sound alike, but maybe the production makes them confuse other people. I don't know.
I have a theory on that. Yeah, I mean, especially, I'm talking primarily the early days. I think people had a hard time. First of all, there was no video, really.
Right.
Nobody knew who was singing. It's, you know, but you can go back to when you were a kid listening to the Beatles for the first time. It took a while to figure out, is this Paul, George, or John singing lead here, or Ringo? Mm-hmm. I mean, Ringo stood out, but the other, you know, I think bands take on these characteristics of each other, even two distinctive voices like Rick and Ben. The important thing with this band in particular was that it was always Rick writing. So Rick's melodic range, he would write to his melodic range, really, what he could sing on a demo. Even if he knew that Ben would do it better, it was written sort of with Rick's melodic sensibilities. So they're singing similar melodies in similar ranges. I mean, Ben was capable of a much broader range, but yeah, once you hear it, it's hard. You're like, you know, you knock yourself in the head. It's like, oh, how could I have ever mistaken these two voices?
Right.
But you know, you're listening to the song, you're listening to the melody. People, you know, like my wife listens to the lyrics almost before she listens to anything. It's like, people hear different things when they listen to music.
That's true. Next song, let's going backwards. We go to the Shake It Up album, and you chose the title track, Shake It Up, the band's second biggest hit, going up to number four. I'm going to assume maybe you chose this song because of Elliott's solo, but you tell me.
Absolutely. It's one of the greatest guitar solos of all time. It's probably my favorite guitar solo of all time. It's certainly my favorite Cars solo. And even that's kind of tight because there's so many great ones.
Right.
But if, you know, I don't want to over-exaggerate it here, but I mean, it's just a spectacular example of an Elliott Easton solo. It is so well designed and thought out and composed to the extent that he uses two different guitars in the same solo. It's interesting. It's like he wanted to sound like one guy triggering off another guy, you know, like, so he used two very different sounding guitars, and you can hear it switch in the middle of it. If you're listening closely, certainly guitar players can hear the difference in tone. And that's a fun thing, but the solo itself is just, it's like a solo with wit and taste, and that's Elliott to a T. For me, it was like at that time I was really into playing guitar already, and I had I think I had lost a bit of the thread when Panorama came out. I think I knew Touch and Go. I don't remember knowing that record. Like, I didn't have it at the time, Panorama, yeah. Which is their third record. We had their first two, my brother and I, and then Panorama came out. I don't remember much about it. And there's reasons probably for that. But then MTV in the meantime comes around, and I remember actually being at like a band rehearsal with some guys when I was like, whatever, 15 or 16 years old, and going past, like, I didn't have MTV yet. This guy's parents had MTV in their TV, and I'm like, what is that? And I'm like, oh, it's the new Cars song. And then I'm listening to the solo going, holy shit, what a solo. And it was around the same time as like the Steve Miller Abracadabra, which had a really cool solo as well. I just kind of put those together in my mind, even though this was way better. Yeah. You know, it's not that long after it came. You know, so you've got like Another Nail from My Heart, which is the Squeeze. Glenn Tilbrook solos are similar, like these beautiful little compositions that you can whistle from start to finish. Tears for Fears come out with Everybody Wants to Rule the World, which has some great two different guitar tone solos. So I was really attuned to this kind of thing at that time.
Yeah. And for me, Shake It Up, almost when you first hear it, you don't expect like an AM pop rock hit like that to have a solo, maybe even have a solo in it. And so for me, that just makes it it just sings all the more for me.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it really is. That was a theme in the Cars, is like, I think Rick felt like, well, Elliott says to this day, he's like, well, the things I brought to the Cars, you know, we all brought different things to the Cars. And he goes, and I brought that certain rootsy element to it. He said, I think that's the stuff that Rick liked the least, you know, in the band, about the band. And Rick really felt like the guitar solos, I think, were cliche and becoming archaic even. I don't know if he felt that exactly at this time, but that solo helped resuscitate this song. It had been around for at least a couple of records, and they didn't put it out because, as Elliot paraphrased David saying, it was dull and pedestrian. But but then David says, yeah, but I did say that, but we messed around with it, and it was really particularly what Elliot did, not just the solo, but these Keith Richards parts, it's a very Stonesy way that really brought it alive for David. And that really kind of, again, that's really a great little example of how the Cars worked, you know, as a Rick song, this could have just been very dull and pedestrian, just like another cliche pop song.
Yeah. It's just such a fun song. I don't know anyone that when that comes on, they're not moving and grooving because it's just so good.
Yeah, I remember it at parties when I was in high school.
Touch and Go from Panorama, the album that you were not familiar with in the day. Are you familiar with it now?
Oh, for sure. It's my dark horse favorite, to point to as like, what, you know, if you want to go deep into the Cars, you probably don't have this record. It holds up. I could see at the time, like I remember Touch and Go. I don't remember. I just remember from the radio, I think, but I don't know. You know, you when you're that age, 14 or whatever I was, or 13, they're 14, I guess. You're there's so many things coming at you. You have so little spending money,
right,
to go buy records. You're drawn in a million different ways. So it wasn't about this record so much, although I don't know. It doesn't matter. But I do remember Touch and Go being on the radio, and it's funny because on his last day of life, in his last interview, John Lennon points to this song as a song that throws back in a lot of ways to the 50s, like his song Starting Over did, which was coming out at the same time. Of course, having John Lennon talk about the Cars was such a huge thing for Elliot in particular, but yeah. I think for all of those guys. And for it to happen on his last day on the earth was quite poignant. But I remember the song, and I remember thinking, wow, this is really cool. It's a dark song. It's like a dark tone sound. You know, you've got this weird – you've got two competing time signatures. So you've got two guys are playing 1, 2, 3, 4, and the other guys, David and I think – and Ben are playing in 5/4. So like take 5, ba 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 ba. And to this day, Greg, when he plays, it has to count by patting himself on the leg to know where he is in the song. And then all of a sudden it breaks into this almost polka chorus. Boom, 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 boom. And it was great. It's a great song. It's got these mournful sort of chords. And it's got one of Elliot's, again, one of his fantastic trademark solos. And it sort of divided the room, apparently. He said when he first played it, he thought it was brilliant. And the guys, he said, you know, one or two or three of the guys thought, can you try it again? He's like, try it again. No, don't they recognize that? And he got really mad and played it again. And it was like, had more energy. They're like, yeah, there you go. You seem like you were overthinking it. And it's also notable for being one of the first scripted videos, and this was directed by Jerry Casale of Devo, and this is before MTV existed. They did Jerry did two videos for them, this one and the title track, Panorama, which is a great video, by the way. So, like I said, these are videos that really, you know, it's like they didn't have much of an outlet. I mean, you know, maybe it would be played on a variety show or a top 40 type show. Like Friday Night Videos didn't even exist yet.
So sometimes Solid Gold would play videos.
Solid
sometimes.
Gold, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah, so it was that kind of thing where you would just send in a video instead of having to go mime to your song. But yeah, great video.
Yeah, I love Panorama. I think that song just goes so many different places musically. Great pick, great choice. And I do love Panorama. I love Give Me Some Slack and Don't Tell Me No. I mean, it's got some cool tracks.
It's just, you know, I could see why, especially coming out with Panorama as the title, as the first leadoff track of the record, why it might have sounded, it wasn't this like accessible, warm, fuzzy pop. It was a bit cold and distant. And I could see why, you know, we all have bands that were like, you know, for me, it was like Violent Femmes. I always remember the like loving, couldn't wait for that second record to come out. I went down to Newbury Street Comics in Boston and bought it. I brought it over a block away to the public library to play on their turntable so I could listen to it. And just being like, what is this? And then like it becomes this dark favorite, like this dark, but it's not what you expect. It's not a continuation. Whereas the first two records, the second record is a continuation. Candy O is.
Sure, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I often think sometimes on the third record like this, the band, after if they've had big success with the first two, they aren't comfortable with that maybe, and so they want to do something different.
Well, that's definitely the case in the Cars. I don't know most bands, but for the Cars, for Rick, it was like, you know, I think it was a bit of like, well, let me show you what I'm really interested in. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I do, as I say in the book, I think the lyrics are hit or miss on it, on the album as a whole. Some of them are really interesting. Some of them are just sort of go by in a very sort of non-register. They don't really register with me. I think there's a bit of cliche stuff in there, you know, nightlife and femme fatales and that kind of thing.
Right. Your next one is Dangerous Type from Candy O, sung by Rick.
Are you out of touch? I guess I never noticed that much. Uranium lover, I'm live on your wire. Ooh, come and take me, whoever you are. He's a lot like you, the dangerous type. We'll be right back.
Gun to Head, favorite Carve song. That's
wow.
Yeah, it's just it's got the pop hooks without being, you know, capital P pop. It's just a great song, but it really builds to this intense. I love songs with vamps like that go out outros that really sort of repeat and go in and go deeper and deeper in. And there's all kinds of great guitar stuff happening. But I mean, and what a sing along! I mean, it's a little bit more. Is it minor key? Literally, yeah, it's a bit minor key. So it's not an obvious jump up and down, let's go type song or Best Friend's Girl, but it's like it's to me it's like almost peak Cars. It's got enough of melody hooks. It's got the textures. But it's really this intensity and this seriousness it's a perfect album closer.
Yeah, it's a great tune. I love it also. Let me ask you about Rick's solo albums in the 80s while the Cars were active. For me, when someone branches off to do a solo album, I expect it to be different from what they do with the band. And I really felt like Rick's first two solo albums weren't. I feel like that kind of fractures the band in a way. What are your opinions on that?
Yeah, I mean, my opinions are in the book. I feel like there's some great stuff. Jimmy, you know, I don't know which record we're talking about, but like his first one, I think, has Jimmy on it.
Yes.
Hey, Jimmy. What's the matter with you tonight? Nothing to do. Can't think of anything to do. Gotta get out of here. Go out and watch a fight. Open up some heads. Go for life. That's not dead. Well, gotta get some kicks instead. Just sitting around, thinking about what's wrong with everything in your life. Tonight, you can't see too well what's going on. There's something going on.
Yeah, and give me something to grab for.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he gets a bit more personal in his lyrics, I feel like, or there's more of him invested in them. And it's interesting to go back to read the contemporaneous reviews of the records. Like, I think it was Robert Palmer of the New York Times, not the singer, but Robert Palmer, I think, said, you know, this is better than any of the Cars records, even the attitude. Whereas I stop short of that by far. I mean, for me, it sounds like it could have been the good start of a Cars record. And it's easy for me to go back and make these sort of critical pronouncements,
sure, and
judgments, but it just sounds flatter to me. It's like, it doesn't have, again, it is a bit more like Panorama. If you think of Panorama as a whole, maybe the song, it's just sort of linear, which is what, you know, it's probably what he was going for, a little bit less pop maybe. But it's not what I love about the Cars. I mean, it sounds like, and I think all the guys in the band, it's easy for them to agree. It's like, yeah, it sounds like Rick's demos that he would bring to us without having us, you know, change them.
Right.
Influence them.
How does songwriting work? I feel like, I know Rick gets songwriting credit on everything, and then Greg will share like a credit on each album. If the players are bringing something to each individual song, how do you feel about that? Should they be getting a credit on that song?
Well, this is an age old thing. I mean, you know, if it's any indication, my band split everything equally. Every dollar in, every dollar out is three guys. It was easy. We were an organic band. We were three friends that formed the band. It's so, you know, REM was very similar at a much grander scale than Buffalo Tom. U2 are like that.
Van Halen was like that.
Van Halen was like that. I don't know if they were like that from start to finish, but they certainly started that way. Mm-hmm. I think AC/DC might have kind of started that way. I forget all the bands, but there's plenty of bands, but they're still, while there's plenty, they're far more the exception than the rule. I mean, yeah. Then you get bands like the Stones, where it's like every song idea that comes through the Stones, whether it was from Mick Taylor or Ron Wood or Mick and Keith themselves, or, you know, Bill Wyman writing the riff to Jumpin' Jack, whatever it is, it's like it was a Jagger Richards song.
You know? Right.
Even though Jagger Richards were not writing anymore together, they were writing separately and bringing ideas to each other. Every band's different. Now, this does, you know, now the, it, you know, I read, I don't know if you read the Mike Campbell book, which is, has a lot of parallels to this book. It's a fantastic book. And he talks about, like, it was always going to be Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. They were going to divide up revenue, 50% pretty much of touring. Everything goes to Tom, and 50 goes to the rest of the band, except the songwriting. Whoever wrote the song, whoever put pen to paper, came up with the melodies or the lyrics or together. So you had mostly Tom Petty with 100% of publishing, occasional, but very important. And more numerous than Greg Hawkes, say, co-writes with Mike Campbell and some other guys in the band. So they, yeah, got some, you know, I think Refugee was Mike, for example. So, you know, every band's different. But that's sort of the law, the rule. Copyright would say it's whoever wrote the melodies, the lyrics, and the chorus, basically. Is now, arranging is not writing, right?
Yeah.
If you ask me, Bill Janovitz, right now, I would say that, listen, if you've got five guys in a band and you make these, and I say this in the book, it's like if your solo records are this way, and then the Cars are this way with this, you know, the same writer, and you're having far greater success with the Cars, and they're bringing much different things to your songs than you do on your own, important things, then I think these are things that deserve some credit.
Right.
And if you don't want to give them songwriting credit, then I think you should at least peel off some revenue from the publishing. It doesn't have to be like Rick Ocasek and the Cars. It doesn't have to be, but it could be Rick Ocasek, and then, but you take the money, but you give a portion of it to your partners, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that's how it should have been with the Cars, but that's, it's easy for me to say. I mean, he was a guy that was very insecure, period. As Elliot said recently, he was a guy that seemed like somebody was always trying to take something from him. And he had worked really hard to find, and through many different permutations. So this is where it differs from bands like REM or U2 or Van Halen. It wasn't brothers. It wasn't friends. It was like the only two guys that had known each other for 10 years were Ben and Rick. And Rick had written everything pretty much. So he took slow control and eventually assembled the right band. And this wasn't a band of, like I said, of friends or anything. So he had had enough of bands, I think, even though this band was so important to him.
Right.
He was going to be the leader, and it was very clear. But it wasn't as clear as, say, Tom Petty. It wasn't really stated as much at the beginning. But as time went on, it became more and more clear, to the point that he really kind of marginalized these guys. Not only didn't give them proper publishing revenue, but marginalized them as figures in the band, you know?
When I was reading the book, you know, because, you know, when you're a kid, all of a sudden there's this band, the Cars, and you're like, oh, look at this band out of nowhere. But man, in the book, so much hard work and so much willing to, you know, sleep in your car and just not have anything to eat and all the things that people aren't really willing to do to really lay it all out there and make it in any type of artistic endeavor. And these guys really believed in themselves. And I mean, you know, no one wants to sleep in the car and eat a can of beans, but the payoff, if you make it, is, you know, is the Cars.
Yeah. I mean, and I have a friend, Michael Malley, who just moderated an event for me out in LA. And we were sort of talking about, you know, things that we were going to talk about before with Elliot Easton. And he said, you know, one of the big takeaways of this book and the Mike Campbell book and other books, he said, is like, at the cost of what, you know, like what, who are you willing to walk over? Who are you willing to compartmentalize in the case of Rick? I mean, he left a family behind in Ohio. His own bandmates didn't know about the existence of this family until like two records in, you know, like two major tours or more into the career, stuff like that. But he was truly desperate and poor and highly insecure and anxious, and it really ate him up. It's amazing that he survived as much as he did through all those years.
Yeah.
And but I will say, probably, well, by all accounts, to very great credit from to his second wife Suzanne, who was there with him through from the poverty years at, from Ohio to Boston, raised two more kids, two more boys. And then he leaves for a 19-year-old eventually, supermodel. And, you know, that's another story.
Yeah.
So, and he compartmentalized that. And, you know, it's like, what are you willing to do? What is your ambition and your drive willing to sacrifice? And who are you going to leave behind kind of stuff?
Yeah. And again, it, for me, it's like, how much work are you willing to put in to not make it? You know, so many bands don't make it.
They
put in just as much hard work and blood, sweat, tears, poverty, and don't make it. So you really have to.
Yeah. And there was a pivotal. I mean, the Cars were a pivotal. 1977 was a pivotal moment for these guys. And
yeah.
People are like, this might've been Rick's last shot. And he was already, you know, it was hidden. It was well hidden until he died even. There were corrections posted after he died of what his age actually was. He was 33 when this record came out, I believe, in 78. So, you know, at the time, the Stones were saying, people were saying about the Stones, I should say that, well, this is some girls, are they still, these guys are still at it? How old are they? They're in their 30s. They're making music. And Rick was older than Ron Wood, you know?
He's starting.
Yeah. He was older than Steve Winwood. He was older than Neil Young. But they came out of like, these are the brand new hot young things, you know?
Yeah.
But it was certainly going to be David's last shot. David had done The Modern Lovers with Jonathan Richman. He had done DMZ in, you know, proto punk sort of garage band in Boston. And this is going to be his last shot. He felt giddy when he snapped into the basement, you know, rehearsals and said, oh, this is all happening, man.
Again, everybody, the book is called The Cars, Let the Stories Be Told. It is out now. You can get it everywhere. Anywhere cool books are sold. Bill, is there a place that people should go to get it that gives you more bang for their buck? No.
I mean, you buy it from your personal favorite bookseller. I mean, I was at Book Soup. I will say that if you want to get a signed copy, I think Book Soup in LA are sending them out. I signed a bunch over there. I signed a bunch at Brookline Booksmith in Massachusetts. And there's also, I think, probably still some on Talk Shop Live where I don't know if there's still some available there. But other than that, you know, I personally like to go indie, but, you know, I'm not somebody that has sworn off Amazon yet, frankly. So. You know, Amazon's been very supportive as well.
Also, the website again is BillJanovitz.com, Instagram at BillJanovitz. And does the band make any money from their participation in this book?
No.
Okay. And they know that going in.
They knew that going in. I was very fortunate to have these three guys sign on. And I think that's probably what management would have wanted. But there's not, like I said, this is not a big lucrative business for anybody.
Yeah.
Book sales at this point. So, you know, they've been not only generous with their time in contributing to the book, they were unlimited in how many questions I could ask them or interviews I could have, but they've been supportive after the fact. Like I said, Elliot Easton met me out for an event in LA, Greg and David did a book launch in Boston, and they're still out there talking. And Elliot posted about it just the other day, buy the book. I mean, that's just because I think they appreciate that their legacy, especially these three guys that were sort of the quieter members in the band, the guys behind the scenes, they're very happy to have their views finally out there.
But a testament to the book and your writing is that if they read this book and didn't like it or didn't agree with it, they wouldn't be doing this event. So, I mean, that's big.
Even further, Greg Hawks wrote the foreword for it after reading it and said, you know, Bill has written the definitive account. And there were things that he learned about the band. I think they all learned things about each other.
And they're probably more in contact now than they were before you started writing this book.
Yeah, they are. That's not just because of me or the book. It's also because they've been working on new music that Rick left behind, old demos and more recent demos that he had made before he passed. And they're fleshing that stuff out together. Not always all in the same room. In fact, yeah. Elliot's done all his solos from LA, which is an amazing, you know, thing to be able to do in the last 20 years or so, to be able to do solos remotely. And not just solos, but parts, and making them car. And I, as I say in the book, I sort of bookended the book with, like, I started off by hearing these demos in their very raw form, with Greg starting to add stuff and David starting to add stuff. And then I heard them at the end with Elliot putting his touches on. I'm like, I had heard these songs go from Rick Ocasek demos to car songs, and I could see the process at work.
There you go. And so I guess they have to get the permission from the Rick's estate to do this, right?
They? Yeah, yeah.
The other band members.
Rick's estate, via their management, sent them these things.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if this sees the light of day, will it be called The Cars?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's got all members of The Cars on some of the songs, because some of them include Ben.
Okay.
The rest of them will be, I think the lion's share will be 4/5 of The Cars.
All right. All right. Well, we look forward to whenever that is released. And with that, I want to talk about the last song you picked for your top five. You picked the first single ever released, Just What I Needed. Tell me why you picked that one.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's the first single. It's the song that broke them before they even had a record. And it brings to the topic of conversation, Maxanne Sartori, who is an important figure in this book.
Yes.
Who, you know, even in Boston circles has been somewhat neglected, forgotten, unknown. But back in those days, she was a 20-something-year-old that came to Boston. She was 22 when she started at WBCN, which was a really influential station where Peter Wolfe started, went on to be in Jay Giles' band as a DJ. A really influential station. And she not only broke Aerosmith, she helped break Bruce Springsteen back when the male jocks were saying, oh, he just sounds too much like Bob Dylan. She helped break Queen, and then she broke The Cars almost, not single-handedly, but almost single-handedly.
Kind of.
By playing their demo of Just What I Needed. Which to this day, from, if you could think of like this song in 1976, 1977, I guess it was, to now, it's like it does not sound a bit dated. It's like every time this song comes on, like all their songs, it's like you don't change the radio station. It's like, oh, it's just instant. You'd never get sick of this song. And it's a good example of The Cars. You know, you've got this build of the band coming in and adding their own parts and layering. So you've got this. You've got the great fat synths of Greg intermingled with like the country western rockabilly guitar of Elliot Easton.
Yeah.
It's just a perfect little song. And it's got the irony in the lyric from Rick, of course. It's sort of the perfect car song.
And hard to believe that this song only went up to number 27. That's crazy to me. Like in my head, I feel like that's a number one song.
If it had come out in their second record and they had established, you know, that they, because this record came out in June. It went gold by October, and then by December it had doubled that and gone platinum.
Yeah.
So it wasn't an overnight platinum, but it went platinum really fast. But then they were established. So Let's Go went to, I don't know, number, that was a top 20 hit, I think.
Yeah.
So that was from their second record. So had this song been their, you know, the leadoff single of their second record, it probably would have been a top five.
And Bill, with that, continued success with The Cars, Let the Stories Be Told. Once again, folks, go anywhere that they sell books and you can get this thing. And with that, our playout song for today will be Just What I Needed. Bill, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Pat.
Take care.
I don't mind you coming here, wasting all my time. 'Cause when you're standing oh so near, I kinda lose my mind. It's not the perfume that you wear, it's not the ribbons in your hair. I don't mind you coming here and wasting all my time. Deep, yeah. You always knew you very well, and you look so fancy, I can tell. I don't mind you hanging out and talking in your sleep. I guess you're just what I.